Today's guest says that building a business is like building a piano bench. I will assume that you are as puzzled as I was when I read the title. So let's meet today's guest. Hello, folks. I'm Pamela Brewer. Welcome to this edition of Mind Talk. And I am pleased to introduce to you Ruthie Postow Birch, who is the author of How to Build a Piano Bench. Ruthie, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, this is quite an interesting title. As you just heard me say, I was a little puzzled, perplexed by the title. But I want to start with where you were born, which was in Alabama. And you certainly, today, you are described as one of the most respected members of the Washington, D.C. business community. You describe yourself as growing up quite poor on the streets of Alabama. Now, you and I both know that we are living in a world, certainly in a time today, when the idea of being poor is frowned upon, it's seen as a personal failing, with much lower expectations of the poor person than someone else. So tell me how you reconcile the current view of poor with your experiences of growing up poor, which seem to be incredibly rich.
Well, the people I grew up with were, I grew up on Patane Street, which was a street in Alabama, in Pritchard, Alabama, that was paved with red clay. All the streets around it had concrete or blacktop, but I guess Patane Street was just too poor to get that. But I always, as a child, I kind of it had a picture of the difference between being poor and being really poor. And I said, in the poor houses, we had grass on the yard. And the really poor houses, they didn't even have grass. They just had dusty dirt. So the street kind of crossed the poverty line. And my parents never, we didn't have everything everybody else had, but they didn't act like it. Daddy always said, he said, he drew the poverty line at Spam. He said, we're not so poor, we have to eat Spam.
All right, so Spam was the poverty line. Okay,
Spam was the poverty line.
That's an interesting poverty line.
some people really like Spam, but we did not have to have that. And to this day, I don't think I've ever had it. But the people were, they were, I don't know, your question, because if people were had dignity, they worked. They were working people. The men worked, the women worked. They wanted, most of them hadn't been able to have an education, or they hadn't had the benefits of things. Daddy had to quit school when he was 12 and go to work. And he was determined that I would go to college and get my education and get off Patane Street and amount to something. That was constant. The people that were there, people with dignity, and I guess they taught me that all kinds of people are interesting. And I met really poor people, too, again, when I taught school in Georgia, because I taught in a sharecropping town. And there were people there who, I was stunned. I had never known a grown-up who couldn't read and write before. And these people had nothing. They had nothing. In fact, I think they had a lot of babies because the only thing new they ever got. But even those people were interesting, too. They all had something to say, something to tell me.
So it sounds like one of the things that we can all be reminded of is that quote-unquote poor doesn't mean much. It doesn't say anything about the person's character, the person's wisdom, the person's creativity. It doesn't say anything about any of that.
No, it just says what they have. And it doesn't even say anything about their pride. I mean, there were some people you wouldn't want to go in their house and eat anything. But most of those people down there, they had pride about what they had. They had pride about how what the things they could do, whether they were good cooks or whether they were good housekeepers, or whether a lady who lived across the street from us, had a collection of little glass dogs. I mean, they were proud of it.
So again, I guess I keep going back to what it seems to me is so important for all of us to remember all the time, which is that it is unreasonable and unfair on both sides to make judgments about someone's worth, certainly based on whether or not you view them as being poor or not poor. And in fact, you talk a great deal about the time that you had to spend learning people. Talk about what you learned as a little one on Patain Street in Pritchard, Alabama, about people.
Well, what I learned back there really mattered in business. You don't have to like everybody, not to judge them. It's like the old "I'm okay, you're okay." But learning about people down there, I saw my Aunt Pauline. My Aunt Pauline was from a family so poor. I never experienced that because my parents had more than, and she was my father's sister, and my parents had more than that. But she wanted so much to be a lady, and she dressed just so, and her hair was always just so. And she, you could see she aspired to something. That she wanted more, and she did it. I mean, she carried herself with such style and grace. I saw some of the older people, and they just were lonely. They wanted to talk to somebody, and they would. I learned, actually, what I learned down there made me successful in business, because I learned that people desperately wanted somebody who was willing to not just listen, but hear them. We sold, I don't know what grade I was in, we were selling boxed all occasion cards to raise money for the school. And I went door to door, every house on Patain Street and Hague Street, and they go in and sit on doily covered chairs or sit on front porches. And people would look through the cards and go, ooh and ah. And then they'd talk and they'd tell me about their children or their grandchildren or sad stories, people who died, people who were sick, things they had done, disappointments. They'd tell me everything. And when they finished telling me, they'd give me the $2 and buy the box cards. And I realized that people will give their hearts and their time and their business to a person who will be interested in them and hear them. So I think that's the most important thing I learned, and the non-judgmental piece. I think somebody said something about a person. I don't know where it was, and it was so unfair. It hurt my feelings. I'm not that person. I don't even know that person. But whatever it was said, I hate unfairness. I think I grew up with that, too. I hate unfair attitudes or treating somebody unjustly. But I think it all came from those people and seeing who they were.
You know, the idea that as a business person, one of the most valuable things that you learned and continue to practice is really the art and the craft and the interest of actually listening to people. And I think it's really fair to say that so many businesses from, all industries could do so much more, be so much more productive and more creative if their top level executives would learn how to listen to their employees and teach that respect all the way across the business so that people learned to listen. It's an incredible skill. You're absolutely right. And too many people don't use it.
Well, over the years, I've heard people, this is staffing is a business where a sales business. We deal with clients and the service we provide is recruiting for them. And I would hear somebody who worked with me send a candidate for a job. The candidate wouldn't get hired. And the recruiter would be, that employer is so stupid. And I said, maybe that employer is so stupid, maybe not, but why don't you just listen and hear what that employer has to say? Maybe it's legitimate. And typically it was. It would be some kind of something that they had found that we missed, or just maybe they just didn't get along with the person, and that was fine too. But and the same thing with candidates. A candidate not wanting a job, well, that candidate's stupid. She's never going to get such an opportunity again. Well, maybe she will. But let's listen to what's wrong with it. We've got to figure her out as opposed to smashing her into a job that she doesn't want. Or maybe she doesn't have information that we need to give her. Maybe it's my daddy always told me that if it's not your fault, you can't fix it. So I always said, try to figure out where it's my fault, where I went wrong, and then I can start over and rebuild it and fix it.
And if it's not your fault, your daddy was absolutely right. You can fix it. There were so many valuable things that you learned as you were a little one growing up that stand you in such good stead today as you have your own staffing company and are doing well. One of the things that you say, that you learned during that all that time that you had to be bored, that you were bored enough to become creative and you were bored enough to figure out ways to fill your time and to develop curiosity. Talk about how those skills came about for you and how you use them today. And then we want to get to the piano bench in a moment.
Okay. Well, my mother worked. Mama worked five and a half days a week at the grocery store. Daddy worked for a long time. He was on the graveyard shift. I had grandma, and I spent a lot of time with my grandmother and have a lot of my grandmom. We were kind of like children together. And she would come up with adventures like, let's wax the furniture. Only we got about halfway done, and she decided we didn't want to wipe the wax. It was too much work. But I were very few children on our street. We were a couple. But so if they weren't around, I remember one day, I lost my roller skate key. My roller skates kept falling apart. So I went down to the barber shop because it's all very small area. I lived in a city, but this was a small, area in it. And got some bubble gum and sat and chewed my gum and then went over to Mr. Smith's store and watched him cut up the meat for a while. And then I went back and stopped at some neighbor's house and let him tell me stories. Then I remember, I think I've got some of my best writing done in church or my best dreaming done in church because I certainly had enforced boredom then. But you come up with ideas. You come up with things. And I also went to a really horrible school system, which was perfect for me because I had a lot of benign neglect. Instead of learning multiplication tables in the third grade, I sat and drew, because we lived in a paper mill town. We had reams of that manila kind of paper there. I drew my life. I drew the little yellow-haired girl first in her own place and then with her red coat and then going to work. And I kind of drew out what my life was going to be when I was in third grade. But I think with time, without activities forced, without every minute programmed, which does scare me a little bit about the kids today, without every minute programmed, I could just sit around and dream or put the two sawhorses together in the backyard and turn them into a limousine. And I'd go get a goblet that we had and put ginger ale in it, and I would go out in my limousine and be with a handsome man drinking champagne. To this day, ginger ale is better than champagne. But it was always play-like. It was always making up games. Or making up scenarios. I wish I could have written them all. And I wish I still had the story of the little yellow-haired girl. And it's been long lost.
The value, though, that you place and that you describe on the opportunity to dream, to be creative, turning a sawhorse into a limousine. you know, as a child, as an adult, you look at that and say, oh, how cute, isn't that silly? But the reality is that that's an incredible skill that, you're right, a lot of children don't have the option to dream and play and create in the way that you did, because every second really is filled with this club, that group, this organization, that activity, and may I say, sadly, this video game. That's my bias, but their lives are so full.
Yeah. Well, you're right. Doesn't project that way, but I'm really very shy and introverted, and spend a lot of my time with my drawing, my cartoons, and writing when I'm not doing business. But I guess, well, a little girl invited me to go to Brownies. Mama said I could go with her for after school. I went, and they had a meeting, and I was like, what are they doing? They're talking about stuff, and then they made flowers out of pipe cleaners. I just thought it was horrible. I hated it. And so the next week she asked me to go again, and I told her no, my mama didn't want me to be a brownie.
Clever girl.
I know, my mama won't let me do that. But it was, I liked having my friends and doing things with them, but I learned early. I guess I learned when I was a mere child that I did not like going to meetings. Which kept me out of committees as much as possible later.
Which, again, is a skill that many people haven't, many adults certainly haven't figured out how to master. The time that gets spent in meetings, again, a whole other story. the name of your book is How to Build a Piano Bench, which, again, is an extraordinary title, given that we're not actually talking about building a piano bench. You, in fact, at this point in your life, as you heard me reference earlier, you have a successful staffing business. You are in the nation's capital. You are a well-respected business person. And yet, the name of your book, How to Build a Piano Bench, Lessons for Success, from a Red Dirt Road in Alabama. That seems like such a stretch.
Well, I built my business, just built my career. I built everything that I did. I did like Daddy built the piano bench. When I was a kid, Mama wanted me to learn to play the piano, so Daddy found a used piano bench, brought it. And I hated it. I did not want to practice that any more than I wanted to learn multiplication tables. I did it for 5 years. But in the middle of that, my piano bench broke. And Daddy said, well, I'll just build you a new one. And Mama said, you don't know how to build a piano bench. She said, I don't need to know how to do something. I just need to know the next right step. I need to go out and buy some wood. And then I need to figure out if there's something I don't have the tools to do, I need to figure out who can do it. So he bought the wood and framed up the top. I bought blocks of wood and found somebody who had the turning, like, what do you ever call it, the turn the legs, make them round, to do that. And he set about building a piano bench that he said, now that we wanted it to be sturdy, and the thing was sturdy, it would hold an elephant. But Daddy didn't just build a piano bench. He said, if I want to build it anyway, I want to build something you'll want to have when you're grown. So he set about and inlaid the top with little tiny strips of wood in different colors. So today, I still can't play the piano, but I have a piece of folk art that Daddy built, because that's what it turned out to be. And one step at a time. You just need to know the next right step. So what I figured later on, you know, I had a career that was a big career in staffing, but it was simple. That doesn't mean it wasn't a lot of work and not a lot of hours, but it was simple. And I try to tell people that when I'm hiring, it's just the next step. And people tend to jump off in all directions at once and never get to the main thing.
You know, you're absolutely correct on that. We're going to take a break, Ruthie, and when we come back, we're going to pick up right here. It's really fascinating, the concept of all you need to know is the next right step. We will be back in just a moment, folks. Ruthie Postow Birch, owner of Ruthie Postow Staffing and author of How to Build a Piano Bench. The idea, Ruthie, that you just need to know the next right step is so powerful. And I think about the people, men and women, very often women, but certainly both, who kind of get pulled up in their tracks because that's not the message that they hear. They don't hear, you just need to know the next right step. What they hear and what they believe is you've got to know everything about everything about everything before you make a step, let alone try to figure out if it's the right step. What do you say to those people who are stuck in that maze, if you will?
Some people won't get that message. Some people won't. And I think sometimes I know that there are people out there who get stuck in it forever. And I see it because, you know, I see them that they had big dreams and they got stuck on the end of the dream as opposed to breaking it down. And it's sad. I can't do anything. That's your job. I can't. There are people I just can't do anything for because they're set and I can't. But there are other. When I meet with people and I talk to people who at least I have some sway with, I tell them break it down to what you do. I don't even know how to answer. My career was very simple. It was very straightforward. I knew that I had to talk to employers in the marketplace because those are the people I was going to deal with. So I spent the bulk of my time talking to those employers. And then I had to listen to them and hear them. And so it just was one thing after another. It was very logical. And then along the way, though, it's funny. I had a lot of fun. I had this very competitive personality. I never told anybody I was competing. I just had it inside. And one day we had an all-company meeting, and it was announced how many sales calls somebody in one of the other offices made. And I was crushed because she made more than I did. So I went back, and I was just my manager was there. I was just totally upset, and I was going to drive myself. She said, yeah, she makes more calls than you do. You have more fun on yours. And I thought, let's see the trade-off. I'm going to keep fun. because my clients told me all these things. They told me stories, and they made it interesting. From stories about their lives to their children to all kinds of personal things. But they also told me and taught me things. Like one of my clients was a Japanese-American who had been in the internment camps. Well, this was at a time when, Snow and Cedars, I don't remember the exact name, that book had not come out. And it wasn't highly publicized that the United States had kept the Japanese in internment camps. And he taught me all about it, and he wasn't bitter. I said, it was an incredible, it took me 2 weeks to fill his secretarial job. And in that 2 weeks, he talked to me and told me all about it and told me, he told me the upside of it, and that is that the Japanese were one of the fastest acculturated groups in this country. So for him to find something positive out of all that, I learned that too. I mean, that he found, instead of being bogged in it, he found, and I'm assuming that extended to his family and the people he knew, because that doesn't happen in a vacuum, that they found something positive in a horrible experience. So how could I not love a career where I'm being educated by people every day?
Did you realize early on that the best career path for you was one that included talking and listening to people?
No, I was afraid I was doomed to be a failure my whole life and never get off Battalion Street because I had that impoverished level of choice. I didn't know what was out there, and I knew I didn't want to teach school. Although when I taught school, I threw myself into it wholeheartedly and had fun. I tried art school and discovered I wasn't Picasso, and I didn't want to live in a garret.
What a heartbreak.
I just went, I was went out looking, and I went on these horrible interviews with, because I couldn't type. And the places that would interview me were not, I mean, just awful. And somebody sent me to this personnel agency, and I went in, and I saw, it was back then, it was not as fancy, we have nice fancy offices with private interview rooms now, but back then it was just a reception area and then one big bullpen, where you have a row, two rows of desks with two chairs at each, because the, and they were all women in that office, would sit and interview at their desks, with everybody, people eating lunch at other desks or everything else going on, people on the phone. But I went in for the interview, and I saw, okay, people were on the phone, and people were interviewing. I thought, I can do that. And I just begged for the job. The manager, and she's from New York City, and I'm right up here right from Alabama by way of Georgia, and she did not want to hire me. But she had to get the desk filled, and I begged, so she did. And I just figured I needed to stay on the phone so she couldn't get to me to fire me. I stayed on the phone. She didn't fire me. And she and I ended up working together for 25 years.
Wow.
Before I started this business. The, so it just goes to show that sometimes the person you think is going to fail, if they want to do it bad enough, they'll do it.
You talk about in How to Build a Piano Bench. I mean, it's filled with lessons that you learned really along your path to bring you to where you are today. And one of the lessons that you describe learning was to work hard, to make no excuses, to stay a steady course, and live in the moment. What does that mean for the adult who's listening now? Stay a steady course. Live in the moment. What does that mean?
I do totally live in the moment, and it can frustrate people who are liking to schedule and move out of that because my brain may not jump fast enough. But growing up where I did, I grew up with people who lived in the moment. They couldn't afford anything else. They had to deal with things today. They had to go to work and earn some money and get school shoes for Gloria, whatever. But they, so I saw that. But I also, the piece of doing the next right step and keeping on a steady course means just don't go crazy and go off and do and think you're doing something when you're not. Sometimes people think they're doing something when they're really not doing anything. We can all do that. But in the moment is, I'm right here, right now. I can have memories of things, but even my memories of things are right here, right now. My husband sometimes will say, next month you're going to have a meeting with Pamela, and I'll go, it's not next month. I'm not there. I'm right here. I just can't jump to it. It's what I'm doing right now. It's funny, as I don't have a lot of regrets either. And now I can torture myself on the times that I think I may have hurt somebody's feelings. But really, as far as my own life, I don't have a lot of regrets because it's a waste of time. Regrets are not in the moment either. So worry is, when my son was in Iraq, people would say, "Are you worried?" I'd say, "No," because it's unthinkable. If something is unthinkable, why you don't think about it? It's that other piece that, so being in the moment, just it keeps you grounded and keeps you away from things that are really destructive, like worry. Worry about something you can't do anything about.
Well, and certainly for those who have loved ones in the military, it's a natural expression of concern to worry. On the other hand, the worry gets you nowhere. It does
exactly.
Nothing for you and nothing for the person you're worrying about.
No, that's the, you know, whenever I find, and it's all of us are going to fall into worry about something or fear of something. But a friend of mine years ago told me, when I was really very concerned, worried about something, and she said, take a deep breath right now, right here. Are you okay? Are you safe? Yes. Well, then that's where you are, is right here, right now. What do you do next? And it was right back to my own philosophy. Okay, right? And I've done it for years. It's like, okay, right now, right here, I'm safe. So what do I do next?
And you know, the interesting thing is that nowadays the concept of mindfulness is all over the place, and people are celebrating and teaching how to be in the moment as a way to reduce your stress, to energize your concentration and your productivity and any number of other things. And you've sort of been living it sounds like, for much of your life.
I don't know any other way to live. I think I have a lot of time to think about what I care about. It's like it's funny that growing up in a society where people assume, you know, that people assume the wrong things. People assume in the South, you know, the women would bow down to the men. The women I knew did not bow down to anybody, and I learned that. I learned independence. I learned that to take care of myself. And I think I'm going off on a tangent. I know I am, because one thing you said made me think of the other, and I was thinking about when I came into my business, it was assumed the men were supposed to be the top producers, and the girls, and until we were 80, the girls were
right.
Not. And it killed me. I never said a word, but I was determined. It took me 2 years to beat their top producer. And I never let him beat me again. But it was that piece of, don't tell me I can't do something because I'm a woman. It's that unfairness thing, whether it's me or whether it's somebody else. If you say that I can't do it because I'm a woman, I can't do it for any reason other than the fact that either I don't have the skill or I don't want to, I just couldn't stand it.
A better approach is, I'm not able to do it right now.
Well, I'm getting it done. I'm taking the, you don't see it, but I'm taking the next right step towards it.
And that's the thing that has propelled you forward, taking the next right step. You say that there are magic words that are useful, and that if you want to be interesting, make the other guy feel fascinating. And if the other guy is fascinating, your life is more fun. And you and I both know that there are people who will hear this and say, if I want to be interesting, then I'm interesting. Why do I care about the other guy? Explain why somebody should care about the other guy.
Well, it depends on what you're... I mean, if you're goal-oriented, then your goal is to win people. And for any reason, whether you're winning people for friends, whether you're winning people for business, it's logical that the other person is the one you have to have an interest in. The magic words. Wow, really, you're kidding. You go through, I could have used those words constantly because people would be talking to me and telling me stories and outrageous stories. I mean, my responses were, wow, really, you're kidding. You really are going to do that. But it's back to the people have this, what is it, the number two need after love is to be heard. The number two emotional need. People will do anything for the person who'll hear them. It's not what you say. I mean, I think I say some funny things, and I can pepper some of those in from time to time, but nobody's going to listen to me if they're not feeling that the respect and the interest in them.
So the four secret, no longer a secret, because now we're talking about it, magic words are, wow, really?
Really, and
you're kidding. And what's interesting is it gets people to talk. They feel like you're invested. You might be, you might not be, but that's a separate conversation. But it gives the other person the information that you care, that you're interested, and that you want to know more.
Yeah, it's typically people will talk to you, and I had the weirdest conversation once. There was a man I wanted as a client, and I called him maybe every couple of months, and he never talked to me. Then one day I called and he picked up the phone. And I talked to him evidently. I talked to him once or so. I guess he knew I had children. But he never took one of my calls. He hadn't taken one of my calls in months. And he picked up the phone and he said to me, "Do you have children?" I went, "Yeah." He said, "Boys?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Don't let them play near the equipment, the big, you know, the big pipes, the big sewer pipes that they'll have out in a construction area." And he said, "My boy played on those. My boy was 15. He was playing on those. And they rolled, and he's dead."
Oh,
and
my
don't
gosh.
I just wanted to tell you, don't ever. That's what that man needed to do. And he never, ever. He got it. He did it. And he never talked to me again. It was, it's like, people are so interesting and so in need of saying something or doing something that matters. I think, you know, I think a lot of people in the world right now are hungry to say something or do something that matters, and they're frustrated because they can't. I think that's the other thing. People want to start and do something big that matters, when all they really need to do is something little that matters.
A lot of times that little thing has big impact.
It does. It does. Just what you said about non-judgmental, just accepting people or and seeing what's right in people as opposed to what's wrong, that has a big impact. Yeah, you're right. The people who want to make a big, who want to do something huge, especially today, and I think they're frustrated by it. And some little thing, they just find a little thing to do.
Yeah, we live in challenging times, and it is certainly important for people to feel better about themselves and to remind themselves that they matter by doing that one little tiny thing that, again, as we're saying, can certainly have a ripple effect. Today, as you've heard me say, you are the owner of a thriving staffing company. And over the years, you've had some interesting experiences with folks as you have attempted to place them in jobs that they said they wanted. So we're going to take a break in a moment. But when we come back, I'd like to talk to you about some of those interesting placement experiences that became a part of the Ruthie Postow staffing history, if you will. So don't go away, Ruthie. We'll be right back. As I was reading How to Build a Piano Bench, I came across your description of a candidate who was a client of yours who wanted to work in a larger building. Do you recall that candidate?
Oh, yeah.
Share that with us, if you would.
Well, she actually came in to see one of my coworkers, and she said that she had been working in this bill. Why are you looking to change jobs? Because the building is not big enough. I want to be in a bigger building. And she went on to say she had worked in a larger building for this man's company, and said, and there were, you know, they had so many men in her office, so many men in the other building. And she said, because she had needs. And She had to have the Met several times a day. So, she'd lost that job because the man's wife decided he was going to take over as the office manager role, which I don't really blame his wife for doing.
Smart woman.
And the job she got was in a small building. She said that it was just two men in her office, and she said, and there's an older man with a business upstairs, and he's awfully nice, but it's just not enough. And that she needed to have her needs met. Now, I do believe we placed her in a job in a big building because that was really her only requirement.
So what did the bigger building mean to her? How did that help her She wanted all the men. So a small building, not a lot of men. I gotcha.
But she would take her breaks with the various men.
Well, that's certainly a very interesting job placement requirement.
You know, you kind of get all you get all kinds. I've had people show up for interviews with the saddest story to me is I had a candidate. She had worked for a man who I admit, and who was Simon Legree, terrible mean man, and he had been very mean and abusive. But she worked for him for 10 years, and she didn't quit. He ended up firing her. His job changed. He couldn't have a secretary anymore. That was what it was. And so the office manager there called and asked me to help her. Well, she had absolutely the most beaten down personality. It was like, it was this mealy mouth, I'm here, it's hard to hear her. Mm-hmm. And I thought, what am I going to do? But her typing, back then typing and accuracy was very important, much more so than now. She typed like 90 words a minute with two errors. It was perfect typing. And a little while later, we got a job. A client called and said he wanted a typist. He did not care anything about personality, anything about anything. All he cared about was that somebody type 80 words a minute with virtually no errors. So I got an interview set up for her and called her and said, I said, I've got the job for you. You're typing. I said, he's so excited to meet you, and he can see you when at whatever time. I hung up. She called me back a little while later, and she said, I don't think I want to go on that interview. I went, well, why? And she said, it can't be a very good company if they're excited about me. And I thought, I cannot help you.
That's heartbreaking.
You need far more skill than I've got. But it was. It was so sad that she thought that of herself. It was incredible.
Did she actually finally go on the interview or no?
No, she didn't. Refused to go.
That
she
is
knew it wasn't
so.
A, it could not be a good or upstanding company if they were excited about her.
Which, you know, is kind of a sad but powerful reminder to people who are in jobs today where they have colleagues who are, you know, beating them down at every opportunity, that you need to get out. If that situation can't be changed and you can't change it, you need to get out. Look at what she paid in terms of self-esteem and self-awareness by being in that job with this man for so long.
You know, I learned a long time ago, there are people out in the world who I don't have the skill. I don't have the skill to help. I don't even know what to say to help them.
Yeah.
They were fully formed long before they met me. And you just go on and find the people you can help and do the next thing. Take the next right step.
If for those who are listening now who may be thinking, you know, maybe I should try a staffing firm to help me find my next right step, what are things to take into consideration if you're actually thinking about working with a staffing company?
Well, pick the right one. There's different staffing companies fill different jobs. In our temporary division, we need people who aren't working, so most of our candidates are college graduates who've been on internships or whatever. And then in our direct hire, a direct hire is more of a search firm where we go and client will come to us to go and get and find a higher life form, which is the executive assistant. These people can run the world. And we go out and we do a search to find them, you know, the person who's going to fit their personality and be able to manage them, because the executive assistant job is really a management job. You're managing a boss and making that boss more effective. So it's, you know, you have to have the people who can fit together personality-wise, because one man's manager is another, I don't know, truant officer or something. So it's an interesting people puzzle is very interesting to do, to figure out who's going to like working with another person. And but I would say the biggest challenge I have is that staffing, people come to staffing firms to get jobs, people come to staffing firms to hire, but it's kind of invisible as an employer. And these days I spend most of my time hiring for us. We're growing. And I, you know, hiring people who want this complex a business, because it's sales business, it's a very complex sales business, where if you're listening, you're listening and really taking in people, because you're not pitching something, you're not shoving, you know, not putting a product in front of them. You're figuring out, kind of like a lot of psychology, what they should do, and convincing them to do it with us, to work with us, whether it's the employer or the candidate. It's that intuiting and listening and absorbing who they are and what they need. It's very complex. It's much more complex for somebody who has sales skills than, say, going out and selling technology. And it's somebody will come to me and talk about it. I said, it's really more of a profession, because you are using professional skills and you're growing professionally. You're not pitching something.
Which I think is an important distinction for many people to realize. There's a huge difference between what you're describing that happens with your firm and just pitching another body to another body.
Right. Well, and we have ourselves positioned differently. We're a lot of the staffing firms are they do a good job. I'm not saying these aren't good firms. They're good for what they do, and what they do is they match resumes and job descriptions, and they don't necessarily meet either person. They match resumes, job descriptions, send the resume, and connect people that way. It's effective for what they do. It's just not what we do. We are involved with the client, learn the client. I try to get all of our people to go out and meet the client at some point. It's even though somebody's always meeting the client, but I try to encourage the recruiters to do that too, even though it's not necessarily part of their job, because it's a different level. It's much more consultative, much more consultative, much more involved. So and we're small. We don't deal with as many clients as some of the big firms. We don't deal with as many clients as any of the big firms, but what we're doing is different.
You said that one needs to choose the correct staffing firm for them. How do you know what's right for you? How does one know that, you know, the person who just looks at the resume and matches it to the job and gives you a phone number and address, that might be right for somebody, but it might be wrong for somebody else. So how do I, as an individual, for somebody who's listening now, how does that person determine what is the right staffing firm for them, for example?
Well, I think you can talk to the firm and find out what kinds of jobs they fill and what they place.
Okay.
And that's one thing. But and also you can look at the websites to see what they do. I think it is going in and figuring out, you know, learning, reading the website, seeing what they do, seeing how they work, and then when you're talking to the people, seeing what kind of jobs they fill and how they do it. So we have a very, very niche market. We deal with associations, nonprofits, and professional services, commercial real estate investment companies, all high end. So we have jobs that are only in those areas.
I see.
We don't have jobs in accounting firms or law firms. We don't do that. So it's if you want to work in a law firm, you wouldn't come to us. If you wanted to work in an accounting firm, you wouldn't come to us. You'd go to somebody who does that. And I know there's different firms. There are a couple of other firms about our size in the marketplace who work similarly to what we do.
So it sounds like if I'm looking for a firm to help me find a job, I need to treat that firm search the same way I would treat my job search, which is to do research and to ask questions.
Right, exactly. And we can't place everybody. I personally feel it's an ethic of not bringing somebody in here if I don't have jobs for them. It's just a matter of, I've had recruiters just bring people in willy-nilly. Stop it. I mean, you're costing that person time and money.
Right.
And feelings by bringing them in here and then not doing anything. I mean, yeah, you're going to meet X number of people who you thought you had all the best intentions, but you don't have a job for. But have those best intentions. Talk to the person first. Find out what they want. Find out, what their parameters are a little bit more before you start dragging them into the office, because you want people to come in and have a good experience. You want to give everybody a positive experience that you've helped them.
You shared with the reader of How to Build a Piano Bench a story of a woman who was apparently really perfect for that particular job and actually talked herself out of the job by talking about her personal life way too much. Are there some general tips that you can briefly offer the listener about the do's and don'ts of actually interviewing?
People do that all the time. Well, my daddy always told me, if you don't want somebody minding your business for you, keep your mouth shut about it. But I have...
Your daddy was full of those.
My daddy was full of them. You don't have excuses. Other children have excuses, but you don't have excuses. People will come in and they would talk about all kinds of things that their kids or their husband. I'm going, leave the kids and your husband at home when you go on the interview. Go in the interview to get a job. Can you? And I would have people go in and talk about hours. And I talked to them and said, let me ask you, these hours are 9 to 6. Can you work these hours? Yes. Do you have any problem working these hours? No. Then why did you talk about it? Why did you bring it up? Why did you say you need to pick your kids up at 6:30? For whatever reason, if you're going to get off at 6, can you get your kids? I mean, it's like, make your own decisions separate from the interview. And if it's a job you can't do or don't want to do, don't go. Don't take it. It's okay. I've been telling people for so many years, this is your life. I'm going to tell you about a job. If you don't want it, it's okay. But give me why. So that you're not, don't go in there and shoot yourself in the foot. But I've had people tell employers the most remarkable things that they just, about divorces. And even if an employer tries to give them a break and say, well, that wouldn't happen. So one woman just... She said, well, I don't think that would happen again. The woman said to her, well, you just never know.
Next candidate.
Yeah,
really. Ruthie, what's the next right step for Ruthie Birch?
Well, I am right now, again, I'm still very active in this company and hiring for it. That's half my job right there. And the other is that I'm writing for the company blog and for my website's blog. And I'm also in the process of writing another book. I've started doing the background on it now. And so I'm excited about that project too, so I really have to compartmentalize.
it sounds like it. You mentioned a website. What's the website for How to Build a Piano Bench?
It's, my name is www.ruthiepostalbirch.com.
Can you spell that for us, Ruthie?
It's Ruthie with an I, R-U-T-H-I. Postow is P-O-S-T-O-W, and Birch is B-I-R-C-H. typically if you put in even how to build a piano bench and Ruthie, you'll end up with it. Google will bring it up. Or it will bring up lots and lots of ways on Amazon, books on how to build a piano bench. Or places where you can buy a piano bench. But it, I've tried different ways. But the website has all the website has the blog and all the information about my speaking and about the book.
That's terrific. And again, those magic words that we really want people to remember. Wow, really? You're kidding.
Right.
Ruthie Postow-Birch, author of How to Build a Piano Bench, Lessons for Success from a Red Dirt Road in Alabama. Ruthie, if there's one more thing you could share to potential employers, is there anything you would like for potential employers to think about as they're going on a search for the right candidate for them?
Probably. Well, I think just I like the story of the Patruscan bed from the Greeks. This man Petruscus had an inn by the side of the road, and he would take in weary travelers, and he promised them a great meal and a comfortable bed for the night. And they would come in, he would give them meal, and then he would take them to this bed, he'd have them lay down on the bed. And if their legs were too short, he'd have them stretched. And if they were too long, he'd cut them off. So sometimes I think we try to fit people into a Patruscan bed as opposed to finding out what they can do. Or we're hiring the wrong people and then trying to put them into that bed. And they end up maimed or crippled or something because of being in the wrong job.
Sounds like a mess either way.
Yes. Not something you want to do.
Not at all. Again, Ruthie Postow-Birch, author of How to Build a Piano Bench. Thank you so much for spending time with us today and sharing your experiences and that next right step philosophy.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a professional of your choosing. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, that email address is Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. Also want to remind you that Mind Talk is available from iTunes and Google Play. You can download the app for free, and then you can just carry Mind Talk with you wherever you go. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. You take care.